Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us a fascinating story about a professor who uses a computer program to answer many of his online students' questions. Few of the professor's hundreds of students realized they were talking with a computer.
Then you know what happens. They not only ask that question about Jill, is she an AI? Once the identity of Jill was revealed, they also asked whether I was an AI.
Then you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Anna Mateo tells us about some American English words that came from the military.
When something is on your radar, you are thinking about it or considering it.
And finally, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, we will tell you about the relationship of the American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Rarely have two world leaders worked together with as much friendship and cooperation as they did.
As they worked together during the Second World War, they came to like and trust each other.
So, you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So, let's get started. Here's higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
Technology is shaping almost every part of our day-to-day existence, including education. Ashok Goel is a professor with the School of Interactive Computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. Goel says he uses the internet in almost all of the classes he teaches. Every term, over 300 graduate students take his class on artificial intelligence. The students never meet in person. All of the classes take place online through a website. The site lets students ask questions and complete their work from anywhere in the world. Having hundreds of students in a class means Ashok Goel has to answer thousands of questions. He has 8 teaching assistants to help him, but even that is not enough to give all the students the help they need. So, in January, Goel had an idea. First, he noted that each term his students were asking many of the same questions. Then he decided to try an experiment. At the start of the spring 2016 semester, he added a new member to his teaching team, Jill Watson. She was able to answer questions faster than most other teaching assistants. And she was available 24 hours a day. It was only at the end of the semester that Goals students learned Watson's secret. She was not a real person like the other teaching assistants. Jill Watson is an AI computer program. Goal says only two students came close to predicting Watson's true identity. He was worried about telling his students because he thought they would not like being part of the experiment. But once they learned Watson's identity, they became very excited.
Then you know what happens. They not only ask that question about Jill, is she an AI? Once the identity of Jill was revealed, they also asked whether I was an AI.
Goal now uses Watson in two other classes, but still does not tell his students which of his teaching assistants is a computer program. He hopes this technology will make it easier for teachers to create their own programs to use in and outside the classroom. And it appears stories like his will only become more common. Ashok Goel says the new kinds of technology becoming available will increase the availability of learning all over the world. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here's Anna Mateo with Words and Their Stories.
On this show, we explore the origin and uses of common expressions in American English. Today, we talk about some words that began life in the military. In the United States, Veterans Day is a national holiday held on November 11th. On that day in 1918, all sides in World War I stopped fighting. Americans originally called this holiday Armistice Day. The name changed to Veterans Day in 1954. A Veterans Day kind of veteran is a current or former member of the armed services. However, veteran also describes civilians. A veteran is someone who has a lot of experience in a particular activity, skill, or job. The opposite of a veteran is a novice or a beginner. But let's get back to military veterans. People in the military like to use acronyms. An acronym is a word formed from the first letters of each word in a phrase. For example, the acronym NATO stands for North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But now people just call it NATO. Some other military acronyms have crossed over into civilian language. RADAR, for example, is short for Radio Detecting and Ranging. RADAR is a device that sends out radio waves for finding the position and speed of a moving object, such as a spy plane. This war term first came into use in 1941. We use radar in a couple useful expressions. To fall off the radar means to disappear. For example, let's say I am too busy to play the ukulele. When a friend asks if I've been playing, I can say, "Playing the ukulele has kind of fallen off my radar. I'm just too busy these days." The opposite of that is to be on someone's radar. When something is on your radar, you are thinking about it or considering it. For example, let's say I have moved to a new city. I have a new job and a new apartment. Then someone asks me if I have joined a ukulele group yet. I answer, not yet, but it is on my radar. In other words, I am actively looking for one. But let's leave the ukulele and go back to war. If you are a pilot of a spy plane, you want to fly under the enemy's radar. This way, they will not detect you on their radar screens. And that is how we use this expression in everyday conversation. When you fly under the radar, you want to be invisible, unseen, undetected. You disappear. If you disappear from a battle in a war, you are MIA. This acronym stands for Missing in Action. In civilian use, MIA often refers to a person dropping out of an activity. For example, if I miss a lot of ukulele practices, my bandmates might describe me as MIA. AWOL is a very different kind of military disappearance. AWOL stands for Absence Without Official Leave. This means a soldier is missing from duty without permission. A soldier found guilty of an AWOL charge can suffer serious punishment. In civilian life, it has a similar meaning. AWOL means you were supposed to be somewhere, but were not. For example, if my friend offered to help at my ukulele concert, but did not show up, she is AWOL. Military people have great acronyms to describe a situation that has gone terribly wrong. FUBAR means something severely disorganized, damaged, or ruined. Some say it stands for Fouled Up Beyond All Repair. Others say it stands for Fouled Up Beyond All Recognition. SNAFU has a similar meaning. This acronym stands for Situation Normal, All Fouled Up. In other words, things are not going well, as usual. We should note, the soldiers who invented these acronyms may not have originally used the word fouled. They may have used a more offensive word that means the same thing. But that word is just not VOA Learning English style. I'm Ana Mateo. I am not MIA or AWOL. I am reporting for duty from Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Anna. Now, we present The Making of a Nation. There are many examples in world history of leaders coming together to meet common goals. But rarely have two leaders shared as much friendship and cooperation as Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill did. Roosevelt was President of the United States. Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain. The two men had much in common. They were both born to wealthy families, and they were both active in politics for many years. And, as Steve Ember tells us, they shared a love of history, nature, and the sea.
Roosevelt and Churchill first met when they were lower-level officials during World War I, but neither man remembered much about that meeting. However, as they worked together during the Second World War, they came to like and trust each other. Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged more than 1,700 letters and messages over a period of 5.5 years. They met many times at large international gatherings and in private talks. But the closeness of their friendship might be seen best in a story told by one of Roosevelt's close advisors, Harry Hopkins. Hopkins remembered how Churchill was visiting Roosevelt at the White House one day. Roosevelt went into Churchill's room in the morning to say hello, but the president was shocked to see Churchill coming from the bathroom with no clothes on. Roosevelt immediately apologized to the British leader, but Churchill reportedly answered, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." The United States and Great Britain were the most powerful of the nations that joined together as allies to resist Germany's Adolf Hitler and his Axis partners. In January of 1942, 26 of the Allied nations signed an agreement promising to fight for the goals of peace, religious freedom, human rights, and justice. The three major allies were the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union. The governments in Washington and London did not always agree. For example, they disagreed about when to attack Hitler's forces in Western Europe. And Churchill resisted Roosevelt's suggestions that Britain give up some of its colonies. But in general, the friendship between Roosevelt and Churchill, and between the United States and Britain, led the two nations to cooperate closely. This was not true with the Soviets. The Soviet Union was a communist country. It did not share the same history or political system as the United States or Britain. And the Soviet Union had its own interests to protect along its borders and in other areas. Relations between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies were mixed. On the one hand, Hitler's invasion deep into the Soviet Union had forced Joseph Stalin and other Soviet leaders to make victory over the Germans their most important goal. On the other hand, shadows of future problems could already be seen. The Soviet Union was making clear its desire to keep political control over Poland, and it was supporting communist fighters in Yugoslavia and Greece. These differences were not discussed much as the foreign ministers of Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States gathered in Moscow in 1943. Instead, they reached several agreements, including on a plan to establish a new organization called the United Nations. Finally, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met together for the first time. They met in Tehran in late 1943, mainly to discuss the military situation. However, the three leaders also considered political questions such as the future of Germany, Eastern Europe, and East Asia. Later, the Allies made further plans for the new United Nations. They arranged for new international economic organizations, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the Allies agreed to divide Germany into different parts after the war for a temporary period. The Soviet Union would occupy the eastern part, while Britain, France, and the United States would occupy the west. Washington, London, and Moscow were united during the early years of the war because of military need. They knew they must fight together to defeat their common enemy. But this unity faded as Allied troops marched toward the German border. Roosevelt continued to call on the world to wait until the last bullet was fired before deciding what would come next. But Churchill, Stalin, and other leaders already were trying to shape the world that would follow the war. Now differences between the Allies became more serious. The most important question was Poland. Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 had started the war. Roosevelt and Churchill believed strongly that the Polish people should have the right to choose their own leaders after the war. Churchill supported a group of Polish resistance leaders who had an office in London. In 1940, Polish flyers had taken part in the Battle of Britain, piloting British warplanes against the German Luftwaffe. But Stalin had other ideas. He demanded that Poland's border be changed to give more land to the Soviet Union. And he refused to help the Polish resistance leaders in London. Instead, he supported a group of Polish communists and helped them establish a new government in Poland. Churchill visited Stalin late in 1944. The two leaders met with Roosevelt a few months later in Yalta on the Crimean coast. All agreed that free elections should be held quickly in Poland, and they traded ideas about the future of Eastern Europe, China, and other areas of the world. Roosevelt was in good spirits when he reported to Congress after his return from the Yalta conference.
I come from the Crimea conference with a firm belief that we have made a good start on the road to a world of peace. There were two main purposes in this Crimea conference. The first was to bring defeat to Germany with the greatest possible speed and the smallest possible loss of Allied men. That purpose is now being carried out in great force. The German army and the German people are feeling the ever-increasing might of our fighting men and of the Allied armies, and every hour gives us added pride in the heroic advance of our troops in Germany, on German soil, toward a meeting with the gallant Red Army. The second purpose was to continue to build the foundation for an international accord that would bring order and security after the chaos of the war. It would give some assurance of lasting peace among nations of the world. That goal, too, in that goal, toward that goal, a tremendous stride was made.
Roosevelt went on to say that the peace cannot be a completely perfect system at first, but it can be a peace based on the idea of freedom. Churchill had the same high hopes. He told the British Parliament after the conference that Stalin and other Soviet leaders wished to live in honorable friendship. "I also know that their word is honest," Churchill said. But as history proved, Roosevelt and Churchill were wrong about the Soviets. In the months after the Yalta conference, relations between Moscow and the Western democracies grew steadily worse. The Soviet Union moved to seize control of Eastern Europe. Stalin began making strong speeches, charging that Washington and London were holding secret peace negotiations with Germany, and the Soviet Union refused to discuss ways to bring democracy to Poland. Churchill wrote later that he had always held the Russian people in high honor, but their shadow darkened the picture after the war. Britain and America had gone to war not just to defend the smaller countries, but also to fight for individual rights and freedoms. Churchill went on to say that the Soviet Union had other goals. Its hold tightened on Eastern Europe after the Soviet army gained control. And Churchill said that after the long suffering and efforts of World War II, it seemed that half of Europe had just exchanged one dictator for another. Churchill and Roosevelt agreed in secret letters that they must try to oppose the Soviet effort. But before they could act, Roosevelt died. And the world began to live through a new war, the Cold War, in the years to follow.
Roosevelt's death, from bleeding in the brain, ended a deep, personal relationship between two world leaders. Winston Churchill later wrote about hearing the news of the death of his close friend. "I felt as if I had been struck with a physical blow," Churchill wrote. He said he was overpowered by a sense of deep and permanent loss. The free world joined Churchill in mourning the loss of so strong a leader as Franklin Roosevelt. But it could not weep for long. War was giving way to peace. A new world was forming. And as we will hear in future programs, it was a world that few people expected. Our story continues tomorrow with a look at the secret efforts of a team of scientists to design and build the first atomic bombs. A reminder, we now bring you The Making of a Nation on Sundays and Mondays on this program. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them both. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can also read, listen to, and download our other programs. And you will find captioned videos and lessons to test your American English skills. We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. You can also send us a message through our website. Please know that however you reach us, we do read every message you send. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour, Universal Time, every day of the year. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.